Zeiss is additional evidence of the electrical nature of the prominences, protuberances, and corona. In the configuration of the cometary nuclei and tails, there was found good evidence that all particles in the comet influence the motion of each other, and the configuration of the streamers in the tails of many comets strongly indicate a mutual repulsion. Thus wrote Professor N. T. Bobrovnikov, director of the Perkins Observatory, 1951. It was also calculated that the repulsion of the tails of the comets by the Sun is 20,000 times stronger than the gravitational attraction, and the implication is that it cannot be caused by the pressure of light, as previously thought, and that electrical repulsion must be in action. From spectral analysis, it is known that the cometary tails do not shine merely by reflected light, and that their light is not caused by combustion either, but most probably is an electrical effect, comparable to the effect of a Gsler tube. In order to explain the general magnetic field of the terrestrial globe, Dr. E. C. Bullard, of Great Britain's National Physical Laboratory, assumed, 1953, electrical currents in the liquid metal core of the Earth. The polar lights have been explained by various scientists as electrical charges arriving from the Sun. Following disturbances on the Sun, there is an immediate disturbance in the ionosphere and radio, transmission, ground currents, and the magnetic field of the Earth. There is also a second retarded but pronounced reaction about 25 hours later, and auroral displays. In 1948, Enrico Fermi explained the enigmatically high charges of the cosmic rays as a result of the positive particles having traveled through magnetic fields in space. In 1951, Rickmeyer and Teller, following an earlier idea of Swan, explained these charges as originating in the Sun. Protons and heavy nuclei could be accelerated to the enormous velocity of cosmic ray particles by an extended magnetic field of solar origin. Both theories assume the existence of magnetic fields in space. I could add to this that if the Earth is a negatively charged body, the great energy with which positive charges, the cosmic rays rushed toward the Earth, is not in the least enigmatic. A negatively charged body attracts positive charges. At Mount Wilson Observatory, Harold Babcock determined, 1947, that some of the fixed stars possess general magnetic fields of great intensity. One of the stars was found to reverse its polarity every 9 days from plus 7,000 Gauss to minus 6,300 Gauss. Zeiss may be understood as a sign that the star is rotating, turning another pole to us every 9 days. The star shows no Zeeman effect in between, that is, when the observer is in the plane of the equatorial belt of the star, in the same position in which we are permanently in relation to our Sun. By 1950, to the Royal Astronomer, Sir Harold Spencer Jones, estimated that magnetic properties were established in more than 100 stars, and the number of identified magnetic stars is rapidly growing. Several years ago, Dr. J. S. Hall, of the United States Naval Observatory, and Dr. W. Hiltner, of Yerkes Observatory, found that the light from certain stars is strongly polarized. It was surmised that starlight must pass through particles of magnetized interstellar dust. The question raised was why the particles of dust should all be oriented in the same direction as their magnetic axes. However, if these clouds of dust are electrically charged and in motion, the common magnetic orientation of these particles is only natural. In June 1950, W. Bade of Palomar and L. Spitzer of Princeton offered a theory of colliding galaxies. By November of 1952, it was definitely spoken of as a titanic collision of two giant star clusters behind the constellation Cygnus, Swan, of the Milky Way. The fact of the big crash was substantiated by strong evidence, the radio noises coming from beyond the Milky Way and sifting through it. Galaxies, each as large as the Milky Way, with numberless stars, were riding one through another, colliding and sending out a terrible SOS through the universe in the form of anguished radio noises. These signals were interpreted by Bade and K. Minkowski as the reverberations of crashes on a galactic scale. After millions of years of traveling with the velocity of light, These signals reached our radio telescopes as clearly audible noises. They left the place of the catastrophe so long ago, yet, because of the magnitude of galaxies, the collision is possibly still going on. The signals that are emitted today will reach our solar system when our sun may have already turned into a dwarf star and our planet into clouds of dust. Not only the fact of the collision of galaxies startled the astronomers, but even more the medium through which it became known. The colliding galaxies send electromagnetic signals, thus evidencing the electromagnetic structure of galaxies and of the very space of the universe. By August 1953, the statement was made that another celestial host of stars was charging on a rival galaxy in the direction of the sky where we see the Crab Nebula, and that still another collision was going on behind the constellation Cassiopeia. In the March 1951 issue of RCA Review, John H. Nelson of the Engineering Department of RCA Communications, Incorporated, announced the results of several years of careful observations on the dependence of regular radio transmission on the position of planets in the solar system. He drew graphs and wrote, "It can be readily seen from these graphs that disturbed conditions show good correlation with planetary configurations. It is definitely shown that each of the six planets studied is effective in some configurations." The press reported, "Evidence of a strange and unexplained correlation between the positions of Jupiter, Saturn and Mars in their orbits around the Sun and the presence of violent electrical disturbances in the Earth's upper atmosphere seems to indicate that the planets and the Sun share in a cosmic electrical balance mechanism that extends a billion miles from the center of our solar system. Such an electrical balance is not accounted for in current astrophysical theories. Short wave frequencies are disturbed when Jupiter, Saturn, and Mars line up, either in a straight line or at right angles to one another." Nelson emphasized that the phenomenon is not due to gravitational effect or tidal pulls between planets and the Sun. "Actually, the phenomenon indicates that the planets are electrically charged bodies. In this connection, the older theory of a direct but unexplained relation between the revolution of Jupiter and the sunspot cycle is seen in a new light. Also, the observation of Stetson, of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that the moon affects radio reception, it is twice as good when the moon is under the horizon as when it is overhead, belongs in the same category as Nelson's observation of planetary influences on the ionosphere. Stetson thought this effect was caused by some radiation emanating from the moon, for a neutral moon could not produce the phenomenon." By 1953, the strange fact was established that the solar tides in the Earth's atmosphere are 16 times more powerful than the lunar tides in the atmosphere, a fact in complete conflict with the tidal theory, according to which the action of the moon on oceanic tides is several times more powerful than that of the Sun. The 50-fold discrepancy is still without an acceptable explanation. These are only a few of the recent discoveries that make a revision of the mechanistic concept of the universe quite mandatory. Exactly because of the accuracy achieved without reckoning with forces that appear to exist, celestial mechanics, a solid work of great mathematical minds for almost three centuries, may seem even more in need of such revision. All this has little direct bearing on the story of worlds in collision, which claims only the effect to be expected if a magnetic body like the Earth should come very close to another magnetic body. It was my skepticism concerning the infallibility of the celestial mechanics, which assumes the celestial bodies to be electrically and magnetically sterile, that was the real cause of the emotional outburst. Let us think of a binary, or double star. Both stars revolve around each other or a common center. A half-revolution period of a few days or only hours is common. Let us assume that the stars of the binary are magnets 7,000 Gauss strong. It is immediately obvious that even should the electrical component of the electromagnets be disregarded, these stars are not moving in a system purely mechanical. But this is enough to render the purely mechanical celestial system fallible in respect also to single stars and equally so to the Sun and its planets. In Jupiter and its moons we have a system not unlike the solar family. The planet is cold, yet its gases are in motion. It appears probable to me that it sends out radio noises, as do the sun and the stars. I suggest that this be investigated. Uranus is the only planet about which we know that, for a considerable part of its revolution, it turns one of its poles toward us. If the gases on Uranus are not in turbulent motion, but have a smooth reflecting surface, I would expect the solar light reflected from the polar regions of Uranus to be polarized. As is well known, light reflected from the poles of a magnet is polarized. It is generally thought that the magnetic field of the Earth does not sensitively reach the Moon. But there is a way to find out whether it does or not. The Moon makes daily rocking movements, librations of latitude, some of which are explained by no theory. I suggest investigating whether these unaccounted librations are synchronized with the daily revolutions of the magnetic poles of the Earth around its geographical poles. See Payne, Gay Pushkin of Harvard, who in the last years has written many long articles against the theory of worlds in collision, in which she asserted that the celestial bodies could not possibly possess electrostatic charges enough to produce any of the observed effects on motion within the solar system, now makes, in the September 1953 issue of Scientific American, this confession: 10 years ago, in our hypotheses of cosmic evolution, we were thinking in terms of gravitation and light. On April 5, 1955, at a meeting of the American Astronomical Society, Dr. Bernard F. Burke and Dr. Kenneth L. Franklin, of the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism of the Carnegie Institution, announced the unexpected discovery of strong radio noises arising from Jupiter. They found it difficult to explain the phenomenon, since no radio noises were expected from planets. The above sentence in the lecture to the forum, predicting noises from Jupiter, was in the typescript of the draft of the lecture as deposited in January 1954 with Professor V. Bargmann of Princeton University, and also as edited by the staff of Doubleday and Company in the summer of 1954, 8 months before the discovery. Pressure. Tomorrow we may contemplate a galaxy that is essentially a gravitating, turbulent electromagnet. There will be more concessions as time goes on. Our Sun and its planets are not outside a galaxy, they are not unique or an exception in the plan of the universe. I like to tell this story. Once, in the twilight hour, a visitor came to my study, a distinguished, looking gentleman. He brought me a manuscript dealing with celestial mechanics. After a glance at some of the pages, I had the feeling that this was the work of a mathematical genius. I entered into conversation with my visitor and mentioned the name of James Clerk Maxwell. My guest asked, "Who is he?" Embarrassed, I answered, "You know, the scientist who gave a theoretical explanation of the experiments of Faraday." "And who is Faraday?" inquired the stranger. In growing embarrassment I said, "Of course, the man who did the pioneer work in electromagnetism." "And what is electromagnetism?" asked the gentleman. "What is your name?" I inquired. He answered, "Isaac Newton." I awoke. On my knees was an open volume, Newton's. This story is told to illustrate what I have said before. Would you listen to anybody discuss the mechanics of the spheres who does not know the elementary physical forces existing in nature? But this is the position adopted by astronomers who acclaim as infallible a celestial mechanics conceived in the 1660s, in which electricity and magnetism play not the slightest role. In the fields of archaeology, geology, and astronomy, the last few years have brought a vast array of facts to corroborate the claim made in Worlds in Collision that there were physical upheavals of a global character in historical times, that these catastrophes were caused by extraterrestrial agents, and that the nature of these agents may be identified. Although I arrived at results in conflict with orthodox beliefs, yet recent years have disclosed new observations and findings, all in support and none in refutation. What I want to impress upon you is that science today, as in the days of Newton, lies before us as a great uncharted ocean, and we have not yet sailed very far from the coast of ignorance. In the study of the human soul we may learn only a few mechanisms of behavior as directed from the subconscious mind, but we do not know what thinking is or what memory is. And in biology we do not know what life is. The age of basic discoveries is not yet at its end. And you are not latecomers, for whom no fundamentals are left to discover. As I see so many of you today, I visualize some of you, 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, as fortunate discoverers, those of you who possess inquisitive and challenging minds, the will to persist, and an urge to store knowledge. Don't be afraid to face facts, and never lose your ability to ask the questions. Why? And how? Be in this, child. Don't be afraid of ridicule, think of the history of all great discoveries. I quote Alfred North Whitehead, if you have had your attention directed to the novelties of thought in your own lifetime, you will have observed that almost all really new ideas have a certain aspect of foolishness when they are first produced. Therefore, dare, and should even the great ones of your age try to discourage you, think of the greatest scientist of antiquity, Archimedes, who jeered at the theory of Aristarchus, 25 years his senior, that the earth revolves around the sun. Untruth in science may live for centuries, and you may not see yourself vindicated. But dare. Don't persist in your idea if the facts are against it. But do persist if you see facts gathering on your side. It may be that even the strongest opposition, that of figures, will crumble before the facts. The greatest mathematician who ever walked on these shores, Simon Newcomb, proved in 1903 that a flying machine carrying a pilot is a mathematical impossibility. In the same year of 1903, the Wright brothers, without mathematics, but by a fact, proved him wrong. In religion, the great revelations and the great authorities, the founding fathers, belong to the past, and the older the authority, the greater it is. In science, unlike religion, the great revelations lie in the future, the coming generations of the authorities, and the pupil is greater than the master, if he has the gift to see things anew. All fruitful ideas have been conceived in the minds of the nonconformists, for whom the known was still unknown, and who often went back to begin where others passed by, sure of their way. The truth of today was the heresy of yesterday. Imagination coupled with skepticism and an ability to wonder, if you possess these, bountiful nature will hand you some of the secrets out of her inexhaustible store. The pleasure you will experience in discovering truth will repay you for your work. Don't expect other compensation, because it may not come. Yet, dare. Extraterrestrials confirmations of Velikovsky's ideas by physical contacts, http://galactic.no/rune/destroycontorigin.htm, http://galactic.no/rune/samjing6.html, 151.